welcome back to the program. It's been America's biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression. Millions of words have been written or spoken about what happened, yet to this day, most Americans have but a vague idea of what brought the world's financial system to its knees. Now our guest Roger Lowenstein, in his new book, The End of Wall Street, brings together the individuals, the stories, and the lessons needed to understand what really happened. Roger Lowenstein is the author of four previous books, including the best-selling When Genius Failed. He's reported for the Wall Street Journal for more than a decade. It wrote the journal's stock market column Heard on the Street. He's also a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine. His newest book is The End of Wall Street. Roger Lowenstein, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, it's a pleasure once again to be talking to you.
Good to have you here. You and I talked when the book came out in hardback. We should mention that it's just out in paperback. We talked about a year ago about the state of Wall Street at the time. We're now a year later, and rather than the end of Wall Street, it looks in many respects as many of these practices and many of the things that we talked about that created this crisis are still in play.
Yeah, they're in play. That's a very good term for it. You know, Dodd-Frank, the law that was passed after the crisis, has a lot of teeth, but using those teeth, the enforcement is up to regulatory agencies, and you know whether they have the gumption and the guts to really enforce the changes will be interesting to watch and critical to watch. I'll give you a small example that can serve as a template for what I mean. The law says banks can't just issue mortgages and get rid of them. They have to hang on to some of them so that the banker has an interest in whether the mortgages are any good. What a novel idea, okay? So the law creates a tiny exemption for very, very safe mortgages. Those mortgages, the banks can issue and sell all of them off of their books. So now that it comes time for those provisions to be enforced, banks are going to the regulators and asking them to widen that exemption to say, in effect, look, we really don't like this idea that we'd have to hang on to 5%. Not 10, 20%, just 5%. They don't want to even hang on to 5%, and not just of a few mortgages, of basically any sort of mortgage they would write. And what do you know, consumer advocates, even as their constituents were so burned by the mortgages that they took before, they're right with the bank saying, that's right, we want the banks to have freedom to get rid of these mortgages because then we know they'll come back and issue more. So there's a lot of pressure, both from banks and from consumers, to telling the regulators, lighten up, let's go back to the races. You know, the economy needs it, we need new housing, all the stuff that got us here in the first place, meaning a push on the regulators to allow mortgages, regardless of whether they're sound. And, you know, let's hope the regulators have learned their lesson and show some fortitude. It's those types of implementation, those types of technical details, one by one, that the regulators are going to have to implement, and that's where we're going to learn, you know, whether there are really going to be some changes that are going to restrain things going forward.
The other aspect with respect to unintended consequences, that many of the issues, certainly not a central issue, but one of the issues that created the easy credit that led to so many of the problems really was the sense of income disparity in the country. And to a large extent, as a result of this crash and recession, that disparity has gotten larger. And the pressure for easy credit at some point in the not-too-distant future is going to be equally intense once again.
You know, Jeff, I think you're right, and I'm very troubled by that. If you think about, you know, the types of compensation that executives in this country get, it's certainly the types of homes they purchase. It's certainly induced, middle class people, I think, to stretch to their limits and beyond to try to keep up with the Joneses. I think the problem of inequality reaches into a lot of ways that we don't suspect when we think about trying to attract capable people to become, say, teachers in the public schools. It's very hard to get a talented person into teaching when investment bankers make what they make. So in response to this crisis, again, the law says you can't pay a banker too much right up front. You have to at least wait to see if the deals that he did are any good. You have to wait to see before you pay him millions whether or not his deals are actually going to bankrupt his bank. Again, banks are fighting back. They're pushing back. They don't want those controls. Will the regulators say, 2008 was enough, thank you. We don't need another depression like we just had. That's what we're going through now.
The other aspect is that so many smaller banks have fallen away as a result of all of this, and I don't know what the numbers are, but literally even this year alone, hundreds of relatively small banks have been closed. The big ones keep getting bigger. And the whole notion of too big to fail, which lies at the core of how the response was structured to this, is arguably more of an issue today than it was 5 years ago.
You know, it is. But I'll take issue with some of the conventional drift on that, which is, I think, as you say, it is at the core, and to a lot of people, the worst thing that happened was we had these bailouts. I think that's a mistake. The worst thing that happened was we had a massive depression. We had unemployment go to 10%. We had millions of people lose their homes and jobs and so on. I'm more interested in the future in making sure we don't have another depression than in making sure that if we do, there are bailouts. Because once the regulators are discussing whether or not to bail out a bank, the battle's really lost. And by the way, I don't think there's really any preventing a future, say, Treasury Secretary from intervening and possibly doing a bailout if he feels or she feels that the system's at risk. Hank Paulson didn't come into office expecting to do bailouts.
Right.
He didn't bail out Lehman. But once he felt that, you know, the whole system was at risk, he decided he had to intervene. And no matter what we say now, when some future Treasury Secretary or Fed chief feels, if they feel the system is at risk, they're going to intervene too. So I think it's better for us to focus on preventing a crisis from happening or preventing it from being so severe. And we know how to do that, by the way. That means keeping leverage lower so that the banks, if they make mistakes, and they will make mistakes, mm-hmm. aren't so leveraged, so they have margin for error. Same thing with homeowners. Don't let them borrow 100% of the down payment. Borrow 70%, 75%. So they have some margin if home prices fall. Those are the types of things I think we should be concentrating on.
Do we have new issues that are continuing to arise, particularly with which the speed at which markets move, the speed at which all of this moves? We look at the flash crash that happened post all of this, and it does make you wonder.
Jeff, if you and I were designing a system today, you know, I would shut that stuff down. I mean, the turbocharged traders that trade, that flash crash was all created by traders who trade in and out of stocks in a fraction of a second. I mean, I can't think of a single solitary social benefit that occurs from computers making trades in and out in less than a second. I have big problems with some of these derivatives, such as credit default swaps, where traders can make what amount to huge side bets, the same as you would going to Las Vegas, on whether companies are going to live or die, only because Wall Street watches the bets they're making, they end up having real-world effects and frightening people away from extending credit. I don't really think we need these regulated casinos. I think they do more harm than good. And these types of activities have led people to question, what is the purpose? What is the end of Wall Street? It used to be about raising capital for industry. Derivatives don't raise any capital. 90% of what Goldman Sachs does today is trading. It's not about raising capital. That's a serious problem.
To the extent that Wall Street has become, as a result of all the things you're saying, more and more disconnected from the reality of the economy, what does that mean for the future of Wall Street?
Well, I think it means that there'll be more, retribution, more anger. You know, a lot of people are, you know, very upset that no one's going to jail, for instance, and you know, when I'm asked about that, my response is kind of cautionary because I'm fearful of a mob mentality or a vengeful mentality. And I, you know, you still have to prove before a jury appears that someone broke a law, right? And I mean, that's important that we maintain respect for law. But I think the average person feels Wall Street does nothing for me, but occasionally wreck the economy, and I think with some justification. You know, it's very hard to see a social value in a lot, if not most, of what Wall Street does, and yet it has very serious repercussions when they go awry, as we've seen.
Is there any value in or any desire on the part of anyone on Wall Street that you've seen so far to reconcile these two things, for Wall Street to do a better job, partly of public relations, but also in terms of reality, reconciling it more with the American public?
Well, you know, in public relations, sure. I mean, they all have very, you know, slick PR, but I sort of shrug my shoulders and say, so what? I saw recently that Goldman Sachs had been defending, representing a client, and the client wanted to know, should they explore a takeover bid? Should they seek out a merger partner? And then they got a letter from Goldman that said that Goldman was no longer representing them because they were now representing a company who was, in fact, trying to take them over. You know, this is a sort of, you know, naked conflict and betrayal that in the Wall Street that our fathers or grandfathers grew up with, this wouldn't have happened. If you represented a client, you weren't going to switch sides and represent their adversary. And it's so mercenary. I'd like to say that that attitude has changed, but I don't think it has. I mean, one of the messages of the book is that Wall Street needs regulation because it attracts people who are mercenary and, if you will, greedy, at least self-interested. So I don't think we can rely on the street to regulate itself. That's a very powerful theme of the book. You know, there are examples again and again of that not happening in the book. So I think it'll be up to, you know, to the public and the government, not to Wall Street to reform itself.
Of course, there is still this belief, I mean, that goes back in the context of this story to Alan Greenspan and others, in the purity of markets, this belief that somehow markets are going to do the right thing, even though Greenspan finally got to recant to that before Congress.
Yeah, he did recant. I mean, he said he was wrong. It reminded me of the, mythical, Titanic captain apologizing for having taken a wrong turn. I mean, by the time Greenspan said this, we'd already hit the iceberg. He repeatedly said, and this is documented in the book, that derivative contracts negotiated by private bankers don't need regulation because bankers just do what's in their own interest. He refused when people came to him in 2004, other regulators, and said, hey, there's some really wacky mortgages being issued out there. He wasn't receptive because his belief was bankers would only issue mortgages better sound because it would be in their interest. The whole notion that bankers would put their own institutions at risk was anathema to his mindset. And that was the ideology that really governed the country from, maybe the early Reagan era till now. Certainly Dodd-Frank and Obama have at least put a break to that and said, whoa, we're going to hold Wall Street, in a different kind of light and hold them to some standards. And Dodd-Frank begins to do that. And as I said before, we'll see if they have the gumption and the guts to follow through on enforcement.
Right, because the culture still exists within Wall Street, the kind of culture that created all of this in 2007, 2008.
Yes, and one of the things I say in the afterword, in the paperback edition, is I look back and note that this isn't the first bubble. You know, we had the stock market crash of 1987. We had the junk bond collapse. We had the SNL fiasco. We had the foreign currency bets and meltdown in the late 90s, LTCM,
right.
The dot-com. So maybe we should start to get the picture that markets are volatile, that they make mistakes, that they seriously go to excess and then overcorrect. And a lot of these incidents were really like the small tremors that might have warned us to the big quake being that we just experienced. But this didn't happen in a vacuum. And if for someone to seriously say that markets are pure, to still hold to this, this Edenic, idea of markets. Look, markets are great. Capitalism is great, but it ain't perfect. That's why we need regulation.
The other part of it is that, there is one consistent theme. I mean, to the extent you look at 87 and 90 and 99 and 07, 08, all these things that you just delineated, you hear each and every time just preceding, this time it's different.
Yeah. I mean, that's, look, every bubble comes dressed in slightly different cloth. One time it's, Japan's going to hold its stock market up. Investing there is different. Another time it's, this is the internet. This is a new world. Another time it's, this is real estate. Real estate never collapses. But there are similarities. And the times you really get in trouble, one, too much leverage, too much debt, because know, what happens if you fail and you don't owe a lot of money, it's just you that fail. But if you're in debt, you fail, and then the person you owed money to, he's got a problem, and the person that they owed money to, and you get this chain reaction meltdown. And the other thing we've seen in these recent crises is a tremendous reliance on computerized risk models, and really a faith that says, you know, if the computer tells me it's okay, it's okay. And all these models do is they look back and they say, well, we haven't had a housing meltdown in the last 10 years. I guess that means we can't have one in the next 10 years. Russia hasn't defaulted recently. I guess they won't do so in the future, although they did in 1998, and so on and so on. You know, computers can really go through a lot of history in a hurry. I've yet to see the computer that can read the future, and it's really remarkable how much faith Wall Street and government regulators put in these models.
The other part of it is the sense of globalization and the way money moves so freely around the world has created more of an incentive for these bankers to be, as you say, more in the moving business than the storage business.
Yeah, that was a phrase of Dick Fuld, by the way, and Lehman Brothers, that when people would ask them whether they were putting too much of many of these mortgage securities in their books, they would say, well, we're in the storage moving business, meaning we're going to move them off our books tomorrow rather than the storage business. Of course, when trading in mortgage securities shut down, everybody was in the storage business. The aspect that you referred to specifically, globalization, is really one that I think Ben Bernanke deserves a fair amount of blame for, because I think he really misread it. And I go into this in the book, that in 2002, people noticed this cycle and said, and the cycle being, we're buying products overseas and in China and Vietnam and, you know, Asian countries, basically. That money's coming back in the form of investments. That capital is keeping interest rates low in this country. Bernanke, of course, recognized this, and he said, you know, it's going into housing. And he said more. He said, this is creating higher housing prices than would otherwise exist. Nonetheless, he thought and argued very forcefully that the cycle was, that the dynamic was benign, and it turned out to be anything but. And you know, we're really living in a new era of globalization, where one central bank alone can't really control the flows of credit in and out of economy. They've got to be aware of what's happening in China, what's happening in the ECB and UK, and so on. You know, as we saw, this crisis wasn't just in America, but it was virtually worldwide.
And how then does that finally affect regulation? Doesn't that have to happen on some kind of worldwide basis to really be effective?
Well, this is what Europe is going through now, because, you know, ultimately, I mean, this is incredibly tricky, because, you know, what you have in Europe is you have various countries with different spending habits. You know, some of them are prudent, some of them, like Portugal and Greece and Ireland, haven't been. And then you have one central bank saying to the strong countries, you know, basically Germany, all right, it's up to you to bail out the rest, because they don't have their own currency. You're all using the euro. So this is, you know, since we're far from having a world government or a world system, and most Americans, I'm sure, wouldn't want one, you know, we have to somehow coordinate so that one economy doesn't destabilize another while still preserving the independence that Americans want and have in their own budget.
And ultimately, do you think that the people that have to deal with this on a day-to-day basis in Washington, on Wall Street, have they really learned from this yet? Has it all sunk in?
You know, Ben Bernanke said something that really worried me a month or so ago. Interest rates are very low, of course. He's keeping them low to re-energize the economy. At the same time, this is stoking fears of renewed inflation, possibly a renewed bubble. It's punishing savers, because savers are getting low rates. It's rewarding borrowers. And Bernanke said, I'll know with absolute certainty when it's time to raise rates. Hmm. Now, you know, the phrase absolute certainty from a guy who missed the onset of the worst recession since the Great Depression, and I'm not totally blaming him for that, because a lot of people missed it, and it was very tough. But if he hasn't learned to get off of notions like absolute certainty, if he doesn't have a little more humility with regard to his own ability to read the tea leaves, you know, I just find that shocking, because, you know, Ben Bernanke in late August of 2008 forecast that the economy was going to keep growing and grow at a faster rate. At that point, unemployment had been rising for 8 straight months. Housing had been falling. Housing prices for 9 straight quarters. Foreclosures had quadrupled. There was no growth to continue. We were in a massive recession already, and the Fed chief didn't know it. So can we get off the certainty bit, please?
Roger Lowenstein, his book, The End of Wall Street, is just out in paperback. And I should mention also that your previous book, When Genius Failed, about long-term capital management, is also just out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, it's really a pleasure, as always, to talk to you.
Thank you.